Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick, and we turn now to our Week in Review. With me in studio is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Renee, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And also with us is Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Good to see you again, Tom.
You too, Chris.
So we're going to start where we just left off before the break, the terror attack in New Zealand. Shooters have left at least 49 people dead. We heard in the previous segment some local reaction. I just wanted to start with your reactions to this attack during Friday prayers to mosques in the city of Christchurch.
Well, you know, there's a lot that we don't know yet, but it does seem from what we do know that this fits into a pattern of ideological violence. In this case, it's probably right-wing white supremacist violence against a Muslim minority at prayers. Sometimes these are, different ideological directions to these mass shootings, but and they're all uniquely horrible. You know, they all have their own unique horror to them. And I think that in this case, in a way, one of the horrors for me is that New Zealand is such a peaceful country. I heard that the entire murder rate for the entire year is less than the number who were killed today. Wow. So I can't imagine how it must be reverberating throughout those communities and that whole country.
I just wanted to take from something Renee just said about this form of ideological violence. There's an underlying problem here. When you start to look, one thing we don't know is how many shooters are involved, whether this was a conspiracy. But having read the manifesto, mm-hmm. It's pretty much the standard manifesto of the radicalized loser that you find around the world. And I think, in the urge to we all grieve for the Muslim community, but there's an underlying problem here, which is this problem of dysfunctional young men who lash out. They kind of go shopping for an ideology, whether it's, John Walker Lind leaving California to go fight in Afghanistan, John Salvi that we remember here in Boston from many years ago. Dylan Roof, Micah Johnson, you can just name them. I mean, the minute I heard about this, I said, almost certainly going to be an under 35, a young male. He's going to have all kinds of grievances, disgruntlement. So I don't know how you flag and tag somebody like that, because we live in an open society. But I think there's a larger societal issue involved here about this kind of young male killer that seems to emerge with disturbing regularity.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the manifesto, and again, we don't know that it's been, I don't think it's been confirmed that it was the same fellow, but probably it was. And, that was out there in social media for some period. And, we just heard a report. You had the fellow from the tech expert talking about Facebook's responsibility here, about the graphic images that were shut down. But you have to also wonder about what kind of, ability these social media sites have to flag violent speech, really, on the website, and maybe, alert authorities to investigate or take a look at whether this guy should. He was not on any kind of terrorist watch list, but he might have been flagged as someone with a violent ideology.
Yeah, I was reading one of the real challenges for experts in this type of scenario is that so much has become comedy material now. There's all this kind of, quote unquote, satire and these bad, sick jokes out there, that for experts to tell what's the difference between someone who's parodying these ideas and then someone who's actually representing a real threat, that's a real challenge for experts.
I think Renee's caution is well taken, that, on the assumption that this really is his manifesto. But on the other hand, it's dozens of pages long. It'd be really surprising because it's not that good. I mean, one of the things that really comes across from it, like most of these manifestos left behind, is how ordinary and boring and unexceptional a person it was that left it, and that there's really nothing in it that's that interesting. So if somebody wanted to craft that, and I think that's actually, by the way, I should add, I don't represent the government, speak for the government on this stuff. But I think that's actually a flag, is that the stuff that, the way you tell the difference between the satire and the other stuff is that there is almost a kind of sonorous dullness to the real stuff, to the people who are really a problem. They're not trying to be funny. They really take themselves very seriously. They believe that they are heroes in the making. And so, but how you flag it, what you do, that becomes, as Renee and I were talking just before we came on the air, that's a problem for civil libertarians.
Yeah, the title of this manifesto was The Great Replacement, which to me, as soon as I read that, I'm thinking of Charlottesville and the marches down the streets of Jews will not replace us. Do you see a connection to what's happening here socially and politically to this attack?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think that this kind of hate knows no boundaries, really no borders, and that the internet and social media so accelerate this, you know, these kinds of hateful projects as it accelerates everything. And also, there are no boundaries or borders to the – that's why it's called the World Wide Web. And so, you know, I think there's every possibility that, you know, the same forces at play here could be and have been at play here.
The connection I see is young and male. You'd have exceptions every now and then, you know, somebody, one of these guys turns out to be an old coot like me, you know, closer in
no
age
women,
to somebody,
no.
But almost no women, right?
Really.
Virtually no women at all involved in these, young men, who are connected via the internet, so that the social pressures that would normally tell people, look, you know, your views are completely off the charts. It's not there because they can constantly go for reaffirmation to find the one other crank who thinks like they do 10,000 miles away. And I think the other thing that unifies all of these shooters is an immense sense of narcissism and entitlement. Mm. They all construct these heroic narratives about how they're going to save. This shooter in New Zealand, a lot of the stuff he said was practically word for word that Dylann Roof said when he attacked the church in Charleston. Nobody's doing anything. We're being overrun. I have to take action. It falls to me, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they are quite alike in a lot of ways.
So there's kind of one big question that's been running through my mind all day, and I want to start. WBUR's newsroom spoke with Scott Brown, U.S. ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa, also former senator from Massachusetts, obviously. Here's what he had to say.
Whether it's our Muslim friends or our Jewish friends or our Christian friends or gay, lesbian, and straight friends or just anybody in the world. I mean, this could happen anytime, anywhere. You know, I don't condone this type of activity. It's unacceptable, and I think the key is to push back by standing tall and go up to your brothers, whether you like them or not, and your friends and people you may not know, and say, hey, you know what? You know, I appreciate you. I care for you, and I'm not going to let this affect our relationship or our status in this community.
So obviously a message there of kind of coming together in the wake of something like this. When you read through this manifesto, one of the main goals was basically to drive the two sides apart and to create kind of inflamed tensions. How do we take a tragedy like this and not let it divide us even further?
Well, you just have to have compassion for, you know, all of humankind. I mean, that sounds kind of squishy, but it's true. And, you know, the same kind of aim to divide us, you know, runs beneath all of these mass shootings that have are ideologically based. And so even the marathon bombing here in Boston. So I think that as, you know, we've already started hearing the expression Kiwi strong to describe New Zealand, they call themselves the Kiwis, to stay together and become unified in the face of this kind of violence.
I think one thing, and, you know, Ambassador Brown is not the, you know, most adept with words, but I think the thing he said that resonated with me is, go out and be among people. Mm-hmm. I think this is really important. We spend so much time alone. Mm-hmm. We spend so much time behind keyboards and screens that we really have come to not think of other people as human beings. I was thinking about the days right after 9/11. What I found really comforting after 9/11, I just got out of the house and I just went to places where there were a lot of people of every, you know, type. And it felt reassuring to me to say, you know, most people in the world are just ordinary, normal people like me. And I think, you know, spending more time around other human beings and practicing small kindnesses in real life is the right way to go here.
I love that message. So unfortunately, we're going to stick with this topic, but shift a little closer to home. Yesterday, the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in a 4-3 decision that a lawsuit challenging federally granted immunity to gun manufacturers can move forward. They ruled to reinstate this lawsuit against the gun manufacturer Remington, brought by families of victims of the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting. Here's Ian Hockley, the father of one of the victims, Dylan, age 6, speaking at a Bridgeport press conference yesterday.
I can't say I'm excited by this ruling. I wish it was never here. But what we've said from the outset is, all we want is our day in court, for the law to be upheld, and for a jury to decide our case.
So a long way to go on this, obviously, but this is the furthest along a lawsuit against the gun manufacturer has gone. What do you guys make of this case?
It's a it is a long road to hoe, and it's kind of a novel legal theory that's at play here. You know, the plaintiffs are arguing that the Remington advertising was designed to appeal to precisely the kind of person you were speaking of, the alienated male, entitled young white guy who, in the case of Newtown, Adam Lanza is a perfect example of that, and that they're using this as a kind of violation of fair trade laws in the state of Connecticut to pursue this case. So, you know, it's something that hasn't really been tried before. It's kind of almost a consumer affairs kind of consumer law, protection law. So it won't be easy to prove a direct link, but I would say that one of the possible advantages of this approach is that if they do go to court, if it does go to trial, there'll be an opportunity to get a lot of material from the gun manufacturers about their advertising strategies, how manipulative and cynical they are, material that's really been hidden from us for a long time.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. Come to that in just a second.
Okay. I'm really uncomfortable with it because I'm not a, I'm not a gun owner. I'm not a Second Amendment activist, but it's guns are a legal product in the United States. Interestingly enough, some of the biggest gun manufacturers in America are in some of the most liberal states in America.
Massachusetts
and Connecticut, which has always struck me as something of a hypocritical approach from the critics of the gun industry, because, there's a simpler way to deal with this, which is if you don't want people making guns in your state, then, make it hard for them to do business in your state. But I worry in general about the principle that you can take a legal product, have someone misuse it. I think the critics would say the gun is designed to kill people, but the guns are designed to do a lot of things. You can certainly regulate advertising. You can talk about where it can be, where it can be shown in public, just as we've done with alcohol and cigarettes and a lot of other things out there. But, where does this end? I mean, at some point, was the Marlboro man responsible for giving, white horse back riders cancer? Cognac being marketed to African Americans. I mean, you can really go down this rabbit hole, and I'm just uncomfortable with the notion that you sort of reach all the way to the manufacturer and say a legal product used illegally makes the manufacturer liable. And I think we'd be better off regulating advertising, because I think that's well within the purview of the government. But to induce or to make a claim on actual responsibility for the and also I think Adam Lanza is probably the worst possible case they could have chosen, because clearly the kid was completely mentally ill. His mother thought that stress management for him was taking him to shooting ranges. Mm-hmm. The person that is probably most responsible for turning him into a killing machine is the first person he killed. So I don't know that there's a whole lot of point in this other than kind of a general sense of social vengeance is understandable, but I'm not sure it's the right way to go.
So you do say going after the advertisement, which is kind of what they're doing here. They're basically saying this marketing campaign is targeting a specific user. But I want to come back to, you mentioned cigarettes there. Renee, you were talking about this discovery process. We talked to WBUR legal analyst, former federal judge Nancy Gertner, yesterday on the show, and she talked about the access to some of the documents that this case could bring.
Consider the tobacco litigation, for example. I mean, the tobacco litigation opened the door to troves of documents that enabled people to look at how much the tobacco manufacturers knew and when they knew it about the danger of the substance. Nobody's ever been able to do that now because of the extraordinary breadth of the federal law and the limited nature of the exception.
So just allowing this lawsuit to proceed could eventually give access to some of those documents. How important is that, do you think?
I think it's very important. It's true that guns are a legal product, but they are not regulated by the consumer protection laws like many other legal products are. Cars can kill people. They're not intended to, But because of that, because they do have an inherent danger, they are regulated by through consumer protection. So you can't, you know, you have to put in seatbelts or whatever. And guns do not have that same scrutiny. And, you know, whether there should be a safety trigger or whatever, the consumer protection kind of efforts might manifest themselves. Guns are not subject to that. And I think that would be a great step forward if, as a result of this trial, we get there.
Well, I'm probably not supposed to undermine my own case by agreeing here, but, you know, I'll also just say, and it is true that if you're a bartender who serves a visibly drunk person, you are liable.
Right.
I imagine if the, you know, alcohol industry was buying ad space at AA meetings or something, you know, we might have a problem with that. So I think that this question of, you know, who are they marketing to? I think, you know, when I say guns are a legal product, the Constitution of the United States says they are a legal product. That doesn't mean they have to be a completely unregulated
exactly.
product. And I think the real argument between people of goodwill who care about public safety here is, how should these issues be regulated? How can the public be protected while our constitutional rights are protected at the same time, which is really what democracy is about.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to turn to another major news story from this week, and as always, is a Massachusetts connection. Some 50 people, including Hollywood actresses Felicity Huffman, Lori Loughlin, were charged here in Boston in connection to the largest college admission scam in American history. At a press conference earlier this week, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling said this.
These parents are a catalog of wealth and privilege. Based on the charges unsealed today, all of them knowingly conspired to help their children either cheat on the SAT or ACT and or buy their children's admission to elite schools through fraud.
And at issue here, a scheme in which wealthy parents bribed college coaches and insiders at testing centers to get their kids into some of the most elite schools in the country. On our show this week, we talked about this, and we had a caller who talked about her perspective as a mother.
It makes me feel pretty betrayed that there are two sets of rules here. As the mom on board handling homework night after night and packing backpacks and trying to send the message that if you work hard, good things will happen, it's really hard to hear that if you have the money, you can buy yourself in.
So this has been a story that's reverberating across the country. What do you guys make of it?
I've been teaching on college campuses since 1985, since I was a young teaching assistant, an assistant professor, my wife taught at Georgetown, Dartmouth, LaSalle, a bunch of other schools. This really... This one really makes me want the federal government to drop the angry hammer of Thor's vengeance, because it's more than, you know, so I think there are folks who are looking at this and saying, well, you know, rich parents are just spreading some money around. That's not what's going on here. This is an attack on the system itself, on credibility and faith in the system that from, you know, you're going to, when this story gets enough exposure, and it will, you're going to have a lot of people saying, so the SAT doesn't matter, achievement mm-hmm. tests don't matter, application packages, essays, athletics, nothing matters. Because if you can find somebody where you can, and the amount of money is yeah. eye-watering. You know, one of the things that struck me here is, if I couldn't, and I don't want to ding any school, I'll say right now, my Massachusetts connection, we're sitting here at BUR. I am a graduate of Boston University.
Me too.
And a loyal alumnus, and feel that this is one of the best things that ever happened to me, was going to Boston University.
And that BU connection is not why we invited you on right. the show. I just cleared
we didn't know, Renee and I didn't know that until 2 seconds yeah. ago. But, you know, if you're going to spend, you know, $500,000 to get your kid to USC, why
it's
not
too
just,
much money.
Yeah, you know, give them the $500,000 and yeah. set them up in a business, or let them. To me, this is rich parents spending money so their egos feel better about what their children are doing,
yeah.
and in rigging this, because the most chilling part to me was the guy who said, "Oh, it's been working for 25 years." Mm. That's terrifying, and I think it just really undermines faith in. An educational system that I think a lot of people already have some pretty shaky feelings about to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so it's not news that the wealthy and connected and privileged parents have, you know, an advantage when it comes to getting their kids into elite schools. I mean, I almost spit out my coffee when I was reading Andrew the U.S. Attorney
yeah,
Lelling say, you know, solidly.
It's not like they bought a building, right?
Well, no, he said there can be no separate college admission system for the wealthy.
Yeah.
Well, of course there is a separate system for the wealthy. I mean, of course there is one. What's galling here is the the blatant fraud and cheating that gets behind it. I mean, you know, there are ways to, whether you're a legacy or you send your kid to private school because you have the money and they have better guidance counselors because of it and they get to take test prep. You know, this is all something that is so-called rigged
right.
for the wealthy to start with. But, you know,
do you see a difference between the legal and illegal of that?
Oh,
though?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I think it's a continuum. Let's
right.
say that. And I think it's also, you know, Tom mentioned the eye-watering sums that are involved here. I think it's also a symptom of the increasing concentration of wealth that we have in this country at the top. I mean, if parents are barely blinking at spending $500,000 to bribe a, you know, soccer coach or whatever it was,
right.
tennis coach, to get their kids into college, wow.
I mean, $6.5 million in one case.
I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, normally people who follow me on Twitter and argue with me, you know that I don't really, I'm not particularly moved by arguments about income inequality, right, and income distribution. This is one place where I have to backtrack from those arguments and say, this is like Russian levels of corruption. This is like Moscow level of corruption where, you know, you have ordinary people, you know, driving trucks and working in restaurants. And then you have a guy who says, okay, I'm going to give you $1 million to take the SAT for my kid. And I should add, I don't think it's I totally understand universities. If someone walked up to Harvard or MIT or BU and said, listen, I'll build you a particle collider if you take my kid. I don't judge a school for doing, as long as, you know, that, I mean, there's at some point the standards can't get too low. But I suppose, you know, for a college to say, well, we probably wouldn't have admitted your son, but since you're going to build us a particle collider, I think we can probably have a discussion about that. That's different than saying we're going to set up a massive infrastructure across the United States to undermine every possible indicator of merit, including standardized exams. That is the one place where, you know, everybody, having gone through all this for years myself as a student and as a teacher, the SAT is like the one place you're really alone, right? I mean, you can have all the test prep in the world, you can have great coaches, but in the end, they shut the door and they point at the clock and you have to go. The idea that you can pay people to do this or get the answers, I mean, it really is hitting the system in its most vulnerable point. And I hope everybody involved pays, well, I was going to say pays a high price. They've already paid a high price, but I hope they pay an even higher price.
Yeah, go ahead. I just want to say that we have to take one half a second here to think about the message it sends to the kids, to the students. I mean, either that their parents are saying, we don't think you're good enough without us, you know, putting our huge thumb on the scale.
Yeah, a lot of these kids involved didn't even know this was happening.
Right. Or
it's
got
to be devastating.
Right.
Yeah.
Or that somehow, you know, you're not worthy if you don't go to an elite college. I mean, these are messages that we're sending to our youth that are really unhealthy, really toxic, and we need to think about that, too.
Or not even an elite college. I mean, there's a...
Yeah. Right,
you know,
see.
I mean, you know, it's not just buying your way into Stanford. It's buying your way into, you know, the next tier, which that was the part that I found even more shocking, because in some cases they were laying out money that was more than the entire full boat tuition, you know, for the school.
We've heard a lot, too, from students of color saying, I've had to deal with all these questions about, do I really belong here? Am I just a case of affirmative action? And this really is just so frustrating to have fought so hard to get here.
I taught in an Ivy League school, and kids that were athletes, kids that were children of color, or legacies of previous students all had to take that criticism, and this is just going to make it a lot worse.
Yeah, that's Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. And Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Renee, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Sidorick. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.